Welcome to another episode of the Armchair Survivalist. This is Kurt Wilson, the Armchair Survivalist, and today is December 8th in the year 2019. If you go to armchairsurvivalist.com, you can figure out how to listen to me. Obviously, you know how to listen to me, at least one way, because you're listening to me. But you go to armchairsurvivalist.com and scroll down, and you're going to find over 20 different ways to listen to me. I'm on all podcasting places, and there's all kinds of stuff there. I just make it simple as that. You can go to the chat room there, and you can listen. Yeah, just clicking on the page chat, it'll take you to the chat page where you can just automatically, it's playing 24/7. And this is a direct feed from Global Star Network, which hosts me on Sundays. Now, there's also a link there. It says if you miss the show, you can listen 24 hours a day to the most recent show. Just click here. Well, you do that, and you hear the most recent show. On the left-hand side of the page, any page, armchairsurvivalist.com, you'll see the little nipper dog listening to the RCA Victor gramophone. Well, you click on that, and that's the archives. That's going to be where you can download any of the current year's shows. Now, on the links on the left-hand side of any of those pages, you're going to see the show notes page. You click on that, and that'll take you to a page that lists all the shows that I've done by name and date. And if you want, the reason I have that there for you is that I'm not one of these hosts that just talks about stuff. I research all week long, and then I post my research so you guys can verify what I'm talking about. You can check source yourself. So that's show notes. So you go to show notes, you look up the show for December 8th or December 1st, and you can see, click on that, and it'll take you to a page that'll show you all the links that I talked about at each show. So let's get some stuff out of the way for Survival Enterprises, my business. Well, we're still closing out some food tablets, heirloom seeds, pepper seeds, and you'll see these things when you on armchairsurvivalist.com, on the right-hand side, you scroll down. You'll see some ads there that I have. And these are not Google ads. These are mine. So they're not tracking you or anything. And you scroll down a little further, and you'll see what's on sale now. Click here. Boom. That'll show you that stuff. I'll be carrying a line of cold steel knives. These are some of the highest quality knives on earth. And the other things that I'm going to be carrying from cold steel are walking sticks, canes. These aren't normal canes. These are actually defensive or offensive weaponry. I don't mean they have knives in them or swords in them. I mean they're usually made out of 17 layers of Kevlar or high-density polypropylene. Most of them are black. They're nice canes, but they can be used as a weapon, and that's what I like. Plus, we're going to be having some swords and bayonets and just other stuff. Now, the chat room, like I said, you click on the chat room, you can go there and listen. The chat room isn't available for talking in like it used to be. Because of all the podcasting capabilities that I have now and other ways that people are listening, most of them, they don't go to the chat room to talk anymore. It used to be, man, I have 50 to 100 people in there. Now I've got two or three. So I turned it off for the public, so you can't talk in there. You can listen, but that's it. So who's going to be talking in there? Me. Me or any authorized moderator can be talking in there. Maybe they have some information they want to give or a story they want to talk about. Oh, I want to give a shout out to my affiliate in Delta, Utah, 540 AM. They play me there on Sundays, 3 to 5 p.m. So, all right, let's get into the economy. This is the big thing. This economy thing is hitting people right now. And I don't mean job-wise. I mean cost-wise. Things are going up. Prices are going up. Things are changing. The New York Fed, and I told you about this, and I've been telling you this each week. The Federal Reserve dumped another $88 billion into the market for banks, into the banks. And this is on November 22nd. December 6th, they dumped another $73 billion. There are, so far, the Federal Reserve has created over $4 trillion just to keep the banks in the United States still standing. Without them and their phony data, their phony information and monetization and pretend money that they're making. There's no money. It's like they're not putting nothing in your hand. They're just making, it's ones and zeros in a computer program. That's all it is. And what's worse about this, the banks are being falsely kept alive. They should be like, you know, survival of the fittest, allowed to die. If that's what it takes, that's what it takes. But you know all the credit cards you're using? The debit cards you're using, the credit cards you're using, you're creating a profile of spending, okay, which your banks have now. And they're selling that data to advertisers, to other companies that will use that data to target you with ads when you're on the internet. Or, you know, I get my PG&E bill, 5 to 12 different ads in there, people selling stuff. What's surprising is that every one of those ads is stuff that I've bought before or I've been looking for. So your bank is selling your information, and they're telling all kinds of different people how you spend. This has been happening in European Union, where you go deposit your money and they start charging you. So when you take in cash, they charge you like 0.5%. And unfortunately, some banks in the United States are starting to charge you that as well. They're charging you to put money in them. This is called negative interest rates. Okay. I remember when you put your money in a savings account, you can get 5%, 7%, 6.5% interest on your money, which the bank uses to make money with. But banks aren't making money now. They're surviving only off the money the Federal Reserve has been putting into them. One of the bad things that's happening, and this is thanks to the millennials, is giving is dropped down. Charity is dropped down in the United States. Americans are the most charitable people on earth, but that charity is dropped down because there's many different reasons. Millennials being an entitlement mentality, it's all for themselves. It's me, not help others. You know, they want everybody else to help everybody else, but they don't want to get involved with it. And this is a real statistic. This is real. And I'll have all of these pages up that you can go and check yourself and see what I'm talking about. But this is hurting all of the charities worldwide. All right, now we're going to get into food and health. I hate to say this. This is a real thing. And if you listen to other people on the internet and other alternative news sites, you're going to hear this. There's a war on food production. If you were a alien sitting in a spaceship, paying attention to what's happening to Earth, you would figure out, yes, there's a war on food production, because magically everything is being aimed at the farmers, and not just in the United States. We're talking worldwide. In the U.S., rules, regulations, laws, restrictions are stopping farmers from planting. And it looks like there's a weather war. It looks like magically something's causing heavy-duty flooding, heavy-duty heat, snow, earthquakes in the Midwest. It's decimating the farmers. Now, here's one of the problems is, and why we don't see it, is that the crop markets, on the stock market, they're 100% controlled by automatic buying and selling computers. It's not humans doing it. It's not a human saying, you know what, they lost the whole orange crop in Florida, so orange juice is going to go up. No, that's not showing up. It's being manipulated. The U.S. Department of Agriculture won't post real data, so the computers keep buying and selling based on phony news. But I can tell you this. Now, I'm going to have a link to a YouTube video. I don't want to play it or cut it or anything like that, because it's too extensive. But I can tell you some of the things and the guy talks about, and not just him talking about it. I get calls from farmers all over the United States, and they tell me the same thing. There's a massive feed shortage. The hay is soggy, so it's fungusing up. and it's garbage. Corn stalks. You know, when they harvest the corn, they usually take the corn stalks and they grind those up and use them as feed. The corn stalks are rotten because of the rain and the flood and now it's snow. And because all of the grains have to be dried, that's dried by using propane. Everything is so wet right now that there's a propane shortage because farmers are drawing so much propane down. Our infrastructure can't supply more propane. The pipes are the pipes, and that's it. And in the EU and in Australia, there's 1,000 small farms closing daily because they can't make any money. They can't survive. China owns Smithfield Hogs. And I talked about this a couple years ago when they bought it. China has been buying up hog farms in the United States for the past 3 or 4 years, doing it quietly. Remember from the news that I've told you, China, a hog is the majority of proteins in Asian countries. So China is buying up all the hog farms. Marfrig Global in Brazil is buying up as many slaughterhouses beef in the United States as they can. And then they export the beef to Brazil. And if you haven't figured this one out, there's something that's been coined called shrinkflation. This is where the same thing that you've always bought now is half the size. Remember those cans of tuna? Well, they're now about 2 ounces lighter. Things are getting smaller for the same price. I went in the store and I'm looking for Diet Right soda. It's the only soda in the world that doesn't have all kinds of contaminants in it and doesn't have artificial flavoring in it. And that my mom was drinking it before I was even born. So I was looking for some, and I'm looking at a whole shelf, 20 feet long, full of cans that are 6 ounces of different sodas. Now, wait a minute. What is that? Anything, any soda. Instead of a 12-ounce can, now they're going to be putting them into 6-ounce cans or 8-ounce cans. Same price. There's no discount on that. I can tell you that right now. So this is a hidden way of raising prices. And if you look at the stores, this time last year, a pound of tomatoes, Roma tomatoes, say, were maybe 59 cents. Now they're 99 cents, if you can find them for 99 cents. Food prices are rising dramatically. And crop losses, all of these crop losses, the grains have been decimated. Corn, wheat, soybean has been decimated in the United States. If you haven't seen it yet, you will see it within the next 6 months. There will be shortages of available food for you to even buy. Now, I'm telling you all right now, if you haven't stocked up on extra food, you better get to it right now. On Wednesdays and Sundays, the food ads comes out in the newspaper, and I buy them, I go through them, and I buy the stuff. If you go to armchairsurvivalist.com, on the left-hand side, you scroll down and you'll see Food Storage 101. That gives you some clues of ideas of how you can start storing food right now. You need to start putting food aside. If you see an ad for tuna or peanut butter or chili or soup, instead of buying 2 or 3 cans, go buy a dozen or a case. That's what we do. I was interviewed by Good Morning America some years back, and I allowed them to come down in my basement into my larder. Not my storage, just my larder, where we draw from. And it's a room about, I don't know, 6 feet wide, maybe 15 feet long. When I opened the door and they stuck their head in there and looked, the whole crew's jaw dropped. They couldn't believe. They've never seen that much food except in a store. And I said, oh, yeah, that's just what we use from, that we pull from that. And the production manager looks at me and he goes, do you mean this isn't the actual food storage? I said, oh, no. This is nothing. This might be, a couple months of food here. The rest of it's elsewhere, and that you can't see. All right. It's Survival Enterprises. We sell this product called Stabilized Oxygen or Ion Drops or MMS or all kinds of different words. It's liquid chloride. It's basically a buffered version of swimming pool shock. And it's used for long-term storage of water. It basically protects your water up to 5 years from getting algae or bacteria in it or fungus or anything. But it's also used as a health product. If you take 10 drops of the stabilized oxygen we sell and you put it in a glass of water and you drink it, when it hits your stomach, the resulting chemical reaction is oxygen. So it can oxygenate yourself. We had a woman, and this is what I'm leading into. We had a woman, she was supposed to have been dead years earlier because she not only smoked, but her lungs were rotting out and she existed on oxygen. She walked around with an oxygen tank at all times. She never left her house. And we would go and deliver a bottle a week to her. She'd come to the door with her oxygen tank and a cigarette in her mouth. And we'd give her the bottle and then we'd leave. And I was always astounded that she didn't blow up. Well, unfortunately, she did die eventually. But somebody, a woman in North Carolina, is doing the same thing. And she did blow up. This normally wouldn't make news or I wouldn't care about it, but she was smoking and she has her oxygen tank and it caught fire. The oxygen and it explodes. It doesn't catch fire. It just blows up. And the reason this caught my attention is because there's a friend of mine here in town, and I won't give you any clues to who he is, but he's a nice guy and he's trying to make a living in his own little shop, and I go over to visit him because he just moved. And he's got this this is 100 feet long hose hooked to him. You know, it's just a thin tube. It goes around his ears and it goes into his nose, who's getting oxygen. So he can walk around his shop and do whatever work he wants to do while he's getting oxygen, and he's got his oxygen manufacturing machine in the back of the shop. It's only a 1,500 square foot building. So we go to the back of his shop. He sits down and he's smoking a cigarette. I go, "What the hell are you doing? You're going to blow this place up." So he goes, "Oh, that's old wives' tale." So I found this article and I gave it to him. I don't think it did any good, but whatever. All right, now we're going to get into Islam. Islam has been in the news. Last week there were three people wounded, stabbed. See, this is what Muslims do. They hack and they stab in Netherlands. And then there was another stabbing attempt or stabbing in London. And I'm not going to go into the stories, but I'm going to tell you guys something. This is how Muslims, and I don't care where in the world they are, they would rather use a savage manner to attack somebody, generally, as opposed to using a gun. Well, if you haven't been in a knife attack, and I'm going to give you some information here. If you've never been attacked by somebody with a knife, unless they're trained, usually what they're going to do is try and slash you. There's different ways to do this, and I'm just going to give you some basics on this. You're going to get cut. Just, I would say, take it for granted. If somebody attacks you with a knife, unless you're very good or lucky, you're going to get cut. I'm not saying you're going to get stabbed. I'm saying even if you defend yourself, unless you have a gun, pull it out and you just shoot them. But generally, they like when somebody attacks you with a knife, they're not going to be attacking you with the knife. They're going to be grabbing you with their other hand and trying to pull you into the knife. You have to work fast and you have to be vicious. You can't just allow it to happen and then, you can't just let it happen. You have to fight. You have to be vicious. It's that simple. You have to be vicious. You need to use surprise, speed, and violence. And don't stop until either you can run away or they don't move anymore. Now, if you have a jacket, if you know it's happening, and you have a shirt, a jacket, a sweater that you can wrap around your arm to protect yourself, do so. If you think you can disarm him, good luck with that, but you will get hurt. So remember, they're not going to lead with the knife, generally. There's always extenuating circumstances, and this is not rocket science, and it's not cut and dried. You won't have time to come up with a plan when somebody attacks you unless you've been trained at it. And the best defense, obviously, is to run away. If you can get trained by somebody, do so. But with somebody with a knife, don't hyper-focus on the knife itself. Have your attention on their whole body. Because the idea, a knife fighter wants to immobilize you so they can use the knife on you. Find an improvised weapon. Now, this is one of the reasons that I'm bringing in these cold steel walking sticks and canes. Even the TSA will allow these on an airplane because they're canes. And they're not, you know, you can't see, there's no gun in there, there's no knife in there, there's nothing in there. They're not even sharp. But they are a weapon. And they can be used to defend yourself in case of an attack. So those of you who live in high Democrat areas, you also have high Muslims. And Muslims, they are it. They are the ones that are going to be doing this. I don't know, Muslims and Mexicans. I have a friend that was stabbed by a Mexican years ago. But he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he did that continuously. Well, let's see. Bunch of Muslim men beat up a Christian preacher in Norway. Pakistan, mother and father stoned their 11-year-old girl to death because they thought she was going to elope. Stockholm, Sweden. Sweden is gone. Sweden has decided that their population is not worth saving for some reason. There was an apartment block, and the government came in and told everybody that all of the apartments were in violation of certain codes. So people couldn't live there anymore, so you need to move out. They didn't rush them, but they forced them to move out. After they all moved out, and these were all retirees, after they all moved out, they cleaned up the apartment complex, reopened it, and moved Muslims in. Now, Paul Joseph Watson has a few words about Muslims in Sweden.
How could I forget about my favorite country, the only country to have a feminist government while simultaneously being the rape capital of a continent? Sweden's come up with a novel new way of addressing its rampant rape problem. Stop importing the rapists? No. Arrest and fine the people who complain about it. One guy who said Muslim migrants were responsible for a lot of the rapes in Sweden was fined $1,265 for committing a crime of opinion. A Swedish police officer, Peter Springer, is under investigation for merely observing that foreign-born offenders are largely responsible for the country's gang rape problem. Are people actually being prosecuted for telling the truth? Well, obviously, yes. But the Swedish government can still claim plausible deniability because they refuse to break down crime statistics based on ethnicity or nationality. That would be racist, and it would also prove everyone right, and we can't have that, can we? But a private study of 4,142 rulings regarding sex-related crimes passed by 40 Swedish courts between 2012 and 2014, found that 95.6% of rapes were committed by men of foreign descent. 2 out of 3 rapes with aggravated circumstances were committed by newly arrived migrants or approved asylum seekers. Official crime statistics show that reported rapes have increased 34% in the last 10 years. But don't worry, because Sweden's feminist government is fighting back by changing sexist street names. Sweden is so politically correct. The police responded to a recent wave of grenade attacks, including grenade attacks against police stations, by expressing concern for those who pull the pin. Sweden is so politically correct. It hired a Muslim migrant to be head of its National Heritage Board, a guy who admits he hasn't, quote, read anything about cultural heritage, and opposes Swedes who want to protect their culture.
Now here's some news from Pennsylvania, and I'm sure we're going to see more and more of this as time goes by. The first, let's see, Representative Movita Johnson-Harrell, who made history by becoming the first Muslim woman to be elected to Pennsylvania's House of Representatives, now faces felony criminal charges. Basically, charges filed against her: perjury, tampering with public records, theft by unlawful taking, theft by deception, and contributions of corporations. What'd she steal? Over $500,000 from a charity that she created. And apparently this charity was created, well, like the Clintons did. They created charities so that they have a way to make money. And she funded herself and buying all kinds of clothes and houses and all of this stuff. This is disgusting, no matter who it is or who did this. This is another one of those articles that shows how the Catholic Church has gone to hell. And I mean that in a literal sense. One of the most disgusting and evil and racist Muslims, who happens to be a representative, Ilhan Omar from Minnesota. Minnesota is no longer part of the United States. It's a little Mogadishu, because it's all Somalis there, apparently. She actually read an Islamic prayer in the Catholic Church on Thanksgiving Day. Let's see. St. Peter's Catholic Church in Washington. A Muslim in a Christian church reading a Muslim prayer. United States, we've had in the past week two shootings. One Navy, one was in, both of them were on military bases. One was on Pearl Harbor. Somebody opened fire, blah, blah, blah. He got shot. They are tight-lipped on it, and they're not telling you anything. So I can tell you right now, it was a Muslim. I've had two people contact me, tell me the guy was a Muslim. He's Middle Eastern. That's at Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor, you know, the military would tell you if it was a white guy. They would tell you if it was a black guy. But they wouldn't tell you if it was a Muslim. And then we had another shooting at the Pensacola in Florida. Pensacola military base. This definitely was a Muslim. This is, I don't understand. Why the hell are we training Muslims? Sooner or later, now nowhere in the world has this concept gained any tread. Muslims are evil and they will kill you. Think about that. If given the chance, a Muslim will kill you. I don't care if it's your next door neighbor. This has been proven all over the world. Ask the Armenians. The next door neighbors were happy to kill them because they're Muslims. And they were given permission to. And this is what happens. This guy's from Saudi Arabia. Well, that news came out today. Now, he killed three people and injured 11 more after opening fire with a pistol. Semi-automatic pistol. Now, the news just came out that military arrested six others, Muslims. Three of them had been filming the attack. We have to understand that Muslims are dangerous. They will kill you if given a chance. This happens every single day in that kitty litter box in the Middle East. Here's a sad thing. You know, we have a list of baby names in the United States, and there's always the 10 most used. In the 10 most popular baby names is Mohammed. They're bringing more and more of these creatures in. It's bad enough that the federal government or the deep state is allowing so much mass migration into the United States. Just by itself. I don't care if they're black, green, blue, yellow, orange, or reptilian. It's too much. It's changing the demographics of every place they move them to. Because these immigrants do not orient themselves into society. They create their own society, their little enclave. But what's worse is when they move in a Muslim, because Muslims will never operate under the Constitution of the United States. The Quran forbids it. And now Muhammad is the 10th most popular baby name in the United States. Now we're going into the category I call the liberal psychosis. And this is about the party of racism, intolerance, anger, lies, hate, and fear. In other words, the Democrats. You ever hear the term yellow journalism? Most people don't even know what it is. They know fake news, but they don't know what yellow journalism is. These are American terms for journalism and associated newspapers that present little or no legitimate, well-researched news, while instead using eye-catching headlines for increased sales. Techniques may include exaggerations, scandal-mongering, sensationalism. By extension, the term yellow journalism is used today as a pejorative to decry any journalism that treats news in an unprofessional or unethical fashion. Now, in England, it's called tabloid journalism, if you might have heard about that. But every country has their own thing, their own name for it. And basically, yellow journalism is fake news. Well, let's see, another town banned the nativity scene, Delaware. Delaware town bans nativity scene. And this is Georgetown, Delaware. And they've had this nativity scene up for years and years and years and years, and they decided to take it down for public safety. A bunch of hogwash. It's just another typical, let's attack Christianity and take it away, and maybe if nobody sees it, nobody will be one. Well, let's see, and here's another one here under the liberal psychosis. The Democrats, of course, they are the ones that cause all these problems. 233 out of 234 House Democrats want to pass a bill that adds, I can't use the term women's rights. Transvestite rights. Let's put it that way. They want to add to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. They want to add protections for sexual orientation and gender identity. So no matter how perverted you want to be, claim that you're one of, 172 different genders, and your boss and everybody around you has to agree. And if they don't, well, it's a violation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Also, what this would do would be, let's say some guy in high school is a sexual pervert, and he wants to pretend he's a female. Well, he has the right then, under this new bill, he has the right to join the girls' wrestling team or track team and function as a female. Yes, this is the liberal psychosis. Now, you know that Virginia, Michael Bloomberg bought the elections in Virginia for Democrats, and they're all rabid anti-gunners. So far, well, they're going to take power January 1st, and they're going to start passing all of these insane bills. There's hundreds of them that they're going to be passing, restrictions of everything. They're clamping down on us degenerates. So there are over 20 counties that are now Second Amendment sanctuaries in Virginia. And as a matter of fact, if bills pass in Virginia that ban civilians from owning weapons, this sheriff has promised to deputize thousands and thousands of people, if necessary, to protect their right to own firearms. Now, that's a cool idea. That is really good. Let's see another thing from ICE. Over 100,000. You know what DACA is? DACA is this program where children of criminal aliens can become citizens. They want to have all the rights as you and me. Okay, over 100,000 of these criminal kids are criminals. They've been arrested. They're trying to reapply for DACA citizenship, and it turns out over 100,000 of them have been arrested already for murder and rape and robbery and things like that. University of Davis, I went there for a short period. In fact, this is all universities in California. We don't know how many in the rest of the United States. There is a mandatory diversity statement that you have to sign before you can be hired. And this guy quit. He said, this is ridiculous. This is communism. It's a political test is what it is. And if you don't sign this, you won't be hired. And basically what it does is it in its own way asks if you're a communist and you hate whites and Christians and males. And if you say yes, they can hire you then. Denver Sheriff Department. You know, most law enforcement agencies in the United States now are trying to hire people. Sheriff's Department in Denver was fined $10,000 for a gross violation of people's constitutional rights. I'm not quite sure how this works out, but basically they were discriminating against job seekers because they'd only hire U.S. citizens. What? I didn't understand that. So the Sheriff's Department in Denver was fined by the Federal Department of Justice for violating some act, and I don't have this, but it's a discrimination act, because they were advertising that you had to be a U.S. citizen for them to hire you. I mean, are they going to hire criminal aliens? I don't understand, and neither do they. But being in Denver, very progressive, they do all kinds of weird stuff. Let's see, one of the Democrat racists, which is, you know, the same word, Democrat, racist, same thing. The one that she pretends she's black, she's not, or she's half Jamaican and half Indian. When I say Indian, I mean from India. Kamala Harris, she dumped her presidential campaign. She just, it's all because of the white people and racism and that kind of stuff. So that's why she quit. And Buttigieg, whatever, the degenerate that's running for, he wants to be the president of the United States. Well, the pervert squad, I don't even, there's so many of these different perversions out there now, I don't know what to call them. There's a lot of them are calling themselves queers. But anyway, they're against Buttigieg because he once worked with the Salvation Army. We know how evil a Christian organization is, don't we? Especially if you're a Democrat. And then we have Michael Bloomberg. Michael Bloomberg, a communist from New York City, who has decided that he wants to be president. He has a better idea of how we can, I don't know, how do I put this? How we can make everybody safer. I've got a couple clips here of Bloomberg talking. And I put them together, and I titled this Bloomberg is a moron. So you guys go ahead and listen to this.
Well, let's just look at the assault weapons ban. We had one in this country for 10 years. Every single weapon used by the shooter in Connecticut would have been okay under the old assault weapons law. They were all exceptions.
Yeah, okay, so the law was flawed. Fix it.
Isn't it pretty hard to define what is an assault weapon? Because it's so easy to write around for manufacturers to create weapons that...
Well, if it can fire a lot of bullets very quickly, good place to start, okay?
And
then you can
say,
argue what a lot is. Okay, let's pick it. Let's say three. If you haven't hit the deer with three shots, you're a pretty lousy shot. That deer deserves to get away. Let's get serious here.
But that would ban most pistols. That would ban most...
No, but pistols are different. You have to pull the trigger each time. An assault weapon, you basically hold it, goes... Blah, blah, blah.
No, those are fully automatic weapons.
Okay. If you have a big magazine, you'll solve your problem. You still have to pull a trigger. But if it's 30 bullets or 20 bullets or 10 bullets before you run out, God wants that deer to live.
But according to gun owners, what you've just described would ban most guns that hunters use today.
If that's what they're using, for God's sakes, why don't they use dynamite? I mean, what's the sport?
The position that a lot of people are going to say is, all you're going to accomplish is taking guns away from the good people and the bad people are still going to
No, no, that's not true. The statistics say that if you have a gun at home, you are 22 times as likely to shoot a family member or a friend as to somebody breaking in. Don't try to go for a gun. You've got somebody pointing a gun at you. You think you're going to be able to outshoot them? That's one of the stupidest things I've ever heard.
So today I just want to touch on a few things, a few of the actions that I've taken to do something about this national emergency rather than just talk about it. I emphasize do something because my candidacy is about getting things done. There's just too much talk about gun violence. I've given my time to organize and reorganize and pull together resources from local groups across the country and defeat Republicans who stand in the way. And I can tell you, I am just getting started no matter what happens in the next election. To begin with, we're going to overhaul the background check system to make it much more effective. No one should be able to buy a gun without passing a complete background check. We'll also close loopholes and gaps in the systems, like the one allowing unmarried domestic abusers to possess guns, and the one allowing sales to go through if a background check takes longer than 3 business days, and the one preventing law enforcement from identifying felons and others who own guns illegally. We'll also be smarter about who can buy guns. For instance, 18 to 20-year-olds are 4 times as likely to commit a homicide compared to older Americans. The suicide rate among teens has increased exponentially over the past decade. And in most states, the legal age for purchasing a handgun from a private seller is still only 18. Think about it. If you have to be 21 to buy a beer, you ought to be 21 at least to buy a handgun or any form of semi-automatic firearm. We'll also work to adopt a 48-hour waiting period for every purchase, and we'll adopt a red flag law at the federal level, like the one Tom helped pass right here in Colorado. One of the biggest problems with existing background check systems has nothing to do with the database. It contains a lot of useful information about criminal history, but most of it can't be used actually to deny a purchase, and we're going to change that by requiring buyers to obtain a permit before they purchase a gun. Because just having a background check isn't enough. The question is, even no matter what the background check says, can you stop them from getting a gun when they're a minor, when they have a criminal record, or when they have psychiatric problems? This permit will allow authorities to screen applicants for dangerous behavior. That includes arrests for violence, like assault and domestic violence incidents, and for arrests for reckless behavior, like driving while intoxicated. Now, I know critics will say that Americans shouldn't need a permit to exercise their constitutional rights, but voting is a constitutional right, and we require people to register to protect the rights of all citizens. And this is exactly the same idea, because a criminal with a gun can destroy our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Permits have worked very well in the 11 states that have adopted them, including New York, I'm happy to say, and it's time to make the law of the land take that up. As president, I will attack gun violence from every angle. I will work with Congress to reinstate the ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, to ban 3D printing of guns, and to require firearms to be safely secured. I'll work to give the Consumer Product Safety Commission the authority to adopt minimum gun safety standards. And I'll declare gun violence to be a national public health emergency, which will increase the funding for and available for research. I'll also increase funding for the ATF to conduct enforcement and for community-based violent intervention programs. I'll ban guns at all schools and colleges. I'll work with business leaders to encourage responsible sales practices and pressure the gun industry to change. And I'll do everything in my power to save lives. Now, my agenda is not some Johnny-come-lately list of borrowed ideas. This is part of my life's work, and I'm just telling you, I will get this done whether I get elected or not. Let's face it, it's going to be a very difficult time to reverse 4 years of cruelty and incompetence. The mind boggles at the thought of reversing 8 years of it.
This is the kind of communistic elitism that we have to fight. And it's ridiculous that it even is allowed to surface in the United States, much less fester and infect whole parts of this society. It's ridiculous. Now, here's the one thing that... I used to have a bumper sticker that said real Americans already have their guns. Well, let me tell you something. The ATF came out and they said, let's see, we have, according to records, and this is the 4473 that people fill out when they buy a firearm. So according to those records, there are 423 million guns in America. 423 million guns. That's just the ones that were bought from a dealer. So you can multiply that by 4 or 5. And that's how many millions of firearms in America right now. And there are 8.1 billion rounds of ammunition being manufactured a year on average. 8 billion rounds of ammunition. So elitist scum like him can take over, pass all the laws they want, and it's not gonna stop anything. Anyway, so, by the way, hell did freeze over this week. and it it's no serious. There was about 15 inches of snow in the Sahara Desert. This is what I'm talking about, the solar minimum. It's changing the weather patterns worldwide. In some places, it's hotter than it's ever been. In other places, it's colder than it's ever been. So, and this is the second time in 40 years that the area had snow. I have to correct an article that's going around the internet. There, and it's on, everybody's picking it up. Drudge picked it up. Steve Quayle picked it up. I mean, everybody picked it up. Jeff Rentz, about this town in Wisconsin that banned snowballs. Well, okay, it's not anything new. It's over, the ordinance is over 60 years old. And basically what it is not just snowballs. It's also throwing rocks or bricks or knives or, you know, whatever, throwing things is what it's called. So, now I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, we had some smart alecks down the street that would make snowballs and they'd put a rock in the middle of it. So they propel this snowball up and it'd come down and you say, ah, big deal, it's a snowball, and it'd hit you in the head and you'd get knocked on your butt because it had a rock. But anyway, this is not a real, this is fake news because that has been around for over 60 years and they're looking at taking it out. There's a dozen other towns in the United States that had the same thing added to it and they're going to be taking it out too. Now we're under the category called Trump, and I watched all of the inquiry hearings, the impeachment inquiry hearings and all of that crap. Mark Dice watched it too, and he summed it up very succinctly.
The impeachment hearings resumed yesterday, this time in the House Judiciary Committee under the careful watch of Chairman Jerry Nadler.
May I make a parliamentary inquiry before you?
The gentleman is not in order for parliamentary inquiry.
Mr. Chairman, before I yield back, I have a motion.
The gentleman was recognized for the purpose of an opening statement, not for the purpose of making a motion.
Parliamentary inquiry, Mr. Chairman.
The clerk will call the roll.
Parliamentary inquiry, Mr. Chairman.
You're not recognized for parliamentary inquiry at this time.
Mr. Chairman, I have a parliamentary inquiry.
The gentleman will suspend. That is not a proper parliamentary inquiry.
It is a proper.
It is not a proper parliamentary
inquiry.
The gentleman will suspend.
Releasing order.
That is not a proper parliamentary inquiry.
This time around, there were no actual witnesses to testify again. Not even anybody who heard from their best friends, sisters, brothers, boyfriends, girlfriend, that some guy who knew a kid that was dating a girl who worked at 31 Flavors heard President Trump say something that would qualify for impeachment. Instead, there were a couple of college professors brought before the committee to tell the American people why they believe President Trump should be impeached, including Stanford law professor Pamela Karlan.
And Article 2 does not give him the power to do anything he wants. And I'll just give you one example that shows you the difference between him and a king, which is the Constitution says there can be no titles of nobility. So while the president can name his son baron, he can't make him a baron.
Congressman Matt Gaetz then had to be the adult in the room.
When you invoke the president's son's name here, when you try to make a little joke out of referencing Barron Trump, that does not lend credibility to your argument. It makes you look mean. It makes you look like you're attacking someone's family, the minor child of the president of the United States. So let's see if we can get into the facts. To all of the witnesses, if you have personal knowledge of a single material fact in the Schiff report, please raise your hand. And let the record reflect, no personal knowledge of a single fact. And you know what? That continues on the tradition that we saw from Adam Schiff, where Ambassador Taylor could not identify an impeachable offense. Mr. Kent never met with the president. Fiona Hill never heard the president reference anything regarding military aid. Mr. Hale was unaware of any nefarious activity. Colonel Vindman even rejected the new Democrat talking point that bribery was invoked here. Ambassador Volker denied that there was a quid pro quo, and Mr. Morrison said there was nothing wrong on the call. The only direct evidence came from Gordon Sondland, who spoke to the President of the United States, and the President said, I want nothing. No quid pro quo.
Thankfully, Congressman Jim Jordan was there to give the American people a summary of the circus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before Speaker Pelosi announced the impeachment inquiry 10 weeks ago on September 24th, before the call between President Trump and President Zelensky on July 25th, before the Mueller hearing in front of this committee on July 24th, before all that, 16 of them had already voted to move forward on impeachment. 16 Democrats on the Judiciary Committee had already voted to move forward on impeachment, yet today we're talking about whether the positions they've already taken are constitutional. Seems a little backward to me. Professor Turley, you've been great today, but I think you were wrong on one thing. You said this is a fast impeachment. I would argue it's not a fast impeachment. It's a predetermined impeachment. Predetermined impeachment done in the most unfair partisan fashion we have ever seen. No subpoena power for Republicans. Depositions done in secret, in the bunker, in the basement of the Capitol. 17 people come in for those depositions. No one could be in there except a handful of folks that Adam Schiff allowed in those depositions. Chairman Schiff prevented witnesses from answering Republican questions. Every Democrat question got answered. Not every Republican question. Democrats denied Republicans the witnesses we wanted in the open hearings that took place 3 weeks ago. And, of course, Democrats promised us the whistleblower would testify and then change their mind. And they changed their mind. Why? Because the whole world discovered that Adam Schiff's staff had talked to the whistleblower, coordinated with the whistleblower. The whistleblower with no firsthand knowledge, biased against the president, who worked with Joe Biden, whose lawyer in January of 17 said the impeachment process starts then. That's the unfair process we've been through. And the reason it's been unfair, let me just cut to the chase. The reason it's been unfair is because the facts aren't on their side. The facts are on the president's side. Four key facts will not change, have not changed, will never change. We have the transcript. There was no quid pro quo in the transcript. The two guys on the call, President Trump and President Zelensky, both said no pressure, no pushing, no quid pro quo. The Ukrainians, third, didn't know that the aid was held up at the time of the phone call. And fourth, and most important, the Ukrainians never started, never promised to start, and never announced an investigation in the time that the aid was paused. Never once. This is scary. The Democrats have never accepted the will of the American people. The facts are the facts. They are on the president's side.
Things got even worse when George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley testified that he didn't even vote for President Trump, but thinks that there's no reason to impeach him.
You need to stick the landing on the quid pro quo. You need to get the evidence to support it. It might be out there. I don't know. But it's not in this record. I agree with my colleagues. We've all read the record, and I just come to a different conclusion. I don't see proof of a quid pro quo, no matter what my presumptions, assumptions, or bias might be.
And according to Dame Pelosi, they'll have Trump impeached by Christmas. That's not a big deal. Let's see, Rob Reiner. Well, I can't read you what I wrote down here. See, I have these notes here. And I use shortcuts to explain each one of the articles that I'm talking about. And sometimes these shortcuts aren't, let's just say they're ripe. Let's see, Rob Reiner, you know who Rob Reiner is. He was on Archie's house and Archie Bunker. And, well, he's an old white man, he's bald and got white whiskers, and he's 70 years old. And he makes an ass of himself on a daily basis. He hates Trump. He hates Trump. And like all other Democrats, hates anyone who voted for him. As a matter of fact, he claims that everyone that voted for him is a, what do they call it? White evangelical and a white supremacist. And every one of us who voted for Trump is a white supremacist. And that's, I don't know how well that's going to go over with all the blacks and Mexicans that voted for Trump. But, you know, reality never gets in the way of a Democrat. Do you know, you've heard all of these whinings and screamings and threats about how Trump has put children in detention and children in cages and children in this. Well, the UN did a study. And the UN is a communist organization that basically hates whites, Christians, Americans, and males. But when they do a study, they actually post it. So they did. It shows the U.S. had world's highest rate of children in detention under Obama, under the abomination. So take that. Trump signed a bill that's going to change how food stamps are issued now. I'm going to tell you something. You go to the dollar store here. I go to the dollar store and I buy things for survival kits. I buy little gizmos in there. Maybe you guys don't know this. They actually sell LED light bulbs in there for a dollar. I went in there and found wireless doorbells for a dollar. I also found a universal TV remote control for a dollar. You never know what you're going to find in there. But I go in there, and here's this family, three baskets full of dollar store crap. Food, you know, cans of corn, lots of cookies and cakes and snacks and sodas and drinks, three baskets full. And it paid with food stamps. And it was a man, woman, three kids. The man and the woman didn't look damaged whatsoever. They didn't look disabled. Looked like they could actually work for a living. And they used food stamps. Or an EBT card, because you don't get food stamps no more. So the White House tightened food stamp requirements. This is driving the Democrats crazy. See, the less victims there are out there, the less Democrat voters there are. And to be a victim, you have to conform to victimology, which is basically, I can't do anything for myself. I'm too stupid. I'm too lazy. I'm too weak. I'm too something else. The white men are keeping me down, or the blacks are keeping me down because they're getting my jobs. I mean, there's all kinds of excuses out there. So basically what it is this. If you want food stamps and you are a work-eligible adult, meaning you're not disabled, either physically or mentally, then you have to have a job that gives you a minimum of 20 hours a week. If you are a work-eligible adult, you have to work a minimum of 20 hours a week to qualify for food stamps. With the economy booming like it is right now, the only reason you don't have a job is because you don't want a job. There are so many ways to make money. It's ridiculous now. In Coeur d'Alene, downtown Coeur d'Alene, the main street is Sherman Avenue. This is where all of the yuppie restaurants and the yuppie stores are. This is where all the college kids go. And I mean, it's a cool place. There's a place called the Iron Horse there, and it's great food. Usually, there's never a sign in any window because of nepotism. You know, the guy knows somebody else, or his daughter will work for him or something like that. You never see a help-needed sign, ever. I walked down the street. I walked about four blocks, and I saw a dozen signs that said, help wanted, help wanted, help wanted. And this is on a street that never advertises for help. So basically, and Trump knows this, if you don't have a job, you don't want a job, and you just want to suck on the government's tit. And he's going to make it harder than ever for people to do that. So that's good. And another thing that he did, you know, pretty much every city, every county, every state has animal cruelty laws. In some states, you can get away with beating your horse. In some states, you can get away with killing your dog or leaving it out to freeze. Or, you know, it's different states have different strangeness on these. Trump signed a bill making animal cruelty a federal crime. A federal crime, not just a city, county, state crime. So you find somebody that's abusing an animal, you turn it in to whoever you want. You want to turn it into the federal government? You go right ahead, because now you can. And the other thing is that you have these creatures from all over the world come here, and most of them are savages, and they will have traditions from their country where they, for a birthday party, they'll take a goat out into the backyard and beat it to death with a baseball bat, while the whole neighborhood listens to the thumping and the screaming of the animal as it dies. You have other societies that simply go to the pound and adopt a half a dozen cats and then takes them home and cooks them. All of these things I've seen personally. Now it's federally illegal. Let's see how long the Democrats let this one stand before they start screaming discrimination. Here's a good one. I don't know if you've heard about this one or not, but Representative Devin Nunes from California sued CNN this Tuesday for, what was this? Let's see, it's a 47-page lawsuit. And he's suing them for numerous egregiously false and defamatory statements about Nunes on November 22nd, 2019, when journalist Vicky Ward reported claims that Nunes met with Ukrainian prosecutor Viktor Shokin in Vienna in 2018 to dig up dirt on Hunter and Joe Biden. That was fake news. So Nunes is not taking this crap anymore. He's got a lawsuit against CNN. Oh, let's see, only $435 million for false and defamatory statements. Let's see how well that one plays out. All right, now we're going to get into government threat. Well, the first thing, we're going to talk a little bit about Epstein again. Remember, this guy was a Jew, and he was a pedophile, and very famous and rich people. Well, he took them to his little pleasure island, and they had sex with underage children, boys and girls. Well, it turns out he was running a honey trapping scam. Honey trapping, well, I'll read you a definition of it. Honey trapping is an investigative practice involving the use of romantic or sexual relationships for interpersonal, political, including state espionage, or monetary purpose. The honeypot or trap involves making contact with an individual who has information or resources required by a group or individual. The trapper will then seek to entice the target into a false relationship, which may or may not include any physical involvement, in which they can glean information or influence the target. So in other words, Epstein was setting this whole thing up and keeping books and videos for blackmail. Well, the news comes out from a ex-Mossad, ex-Israeli CIA, if you want to put it that way, that he worked for the Israelis. And he set these people up to blackmail to make sure that the Israelis could get all the information from him, and they would perform tasks that they wanted him to do. So this is coming out. More and more is coming out. And unfortunately, more and more of Epstein's associates, like his banker, are ending up committing suicide. You know, standard suicide by having your hands duct taped behind you and you hang yourself. That kind of suicide. Or shooting yourself in the back of the head with two barrels of a shotgun. You know, that kind of stuff. Now, I've got, because I get information from the Department of Homeland Security all the time. I get, and all of their agencies below the Homeland Security. So we have this office, and this is, you know, if you thought see something, say something was bad, wait till you hear this. There's a BMAP program, Bomb Making Materials Awareness Program, where they're asking for clerks in stores to turn people in. And powerful explosives can be made from common consumer goods like pool sanitizers, fertilizers, and paint removers that are bought and sold every day in communities across the United States. An educated and proactive public is a key to prevention. So what they want to do, the government wants to come in and train people, like people who work at Home Depot and Lowe's and Ace Hardware. So if somebody walks in and buys, a gallon of pool sanitizer and a gallon of acetone to call this number. It may or may not be a problem, but who knows? Just turn them in. You know, I'll have links to all of this stuff on my website. That way you don't have to believe me. You can go find it out for yourself. Now, we know Facebook is busy banning everything that has to do with patriotism, Americanism. They're towing the government's line. When I say government, I mean deep state. I don't mean the real government. I mean deep state, right? These are the State Department people. These are the people in charge of everything, these little subgroups, these little departments in there. They're displaying, well, let me phrase that. Facebook's banning displays of patriotism for all white Americans. Okay? In other words, if you came on and you were black on Facebook and said, I'm proud to be black, I'm proud to be a Mexican, I'm proud to be red, green, blue, I'm proud to be a reptile, I'm proud to be whatever, that's cool. But if you dare to say, I'm proud to be white, you'll be banned. I'm not kidding. This is happening, and I've seen it happen, and I've had people call me who said that they're not racist, but they... One girl is Scandinavian, and her family goes back thousands of years. And she has pictures. And what do Scandinavians look like? They're white, blonde hair, blue eyes, kind of. Most of them are. So she has pictures all over her website of other white, blonde hair, blue-eyed girls. And I don't mean, this is not a sexual thing. This is an organization. She got banned for racism because there were no black women there. You remember the term shadow banning? You heard that on Twitter, if you cared. I don't, but it's an article, right? So there's people out there that do care. And Twitter come out and said, we don't shadow ban. That's ridiculous. How dare you say something like that? Shadow ban is this. Say you make a post and you have 1,000 followers. Well, Twitter will only let that post be seen by maybe 20 people. They hide it from everyone else. Well, they came out and lied and said, no, we don't do that. We never would do that. Now, when you sign up for Twitter, they have this terms of service, right? It's about 87 pages long. Nobody ever reads them. Let me tell you what it says in there. We may also remove or refuse to distribute any content on the services, limit distribution or visibility of any content. You follow that? In English, it means they can shadow ban you, and you just signed away your rights to argue about it. Oh, but they did allow, you're going to love this one, in the terms of service, they do allow pictures now on Twitter of naked children. As long as there's no sexuality there, right? As long as it's non-sexualized. So you can have pictures of naked children on Twitter now. That's okay. Do you remember, I don't remember, let's see, it was maybe 2 years ago, a year ago, that Trump passed a law. See, these things nobody ever finds out about. All of these little things nobody finds out about because the mainstream media will never tell you the good things that Trump does. By the way, if you go read the show notes, every show notes will have, it's got what's called a sticky post. Under the Trump category will be a link to a page that lists everything that he has done. So you will have that ammunition if you need to prove something to some liberal that you're arguing with. Well, he passed a rule that made transparency of costs, price transparency for hospitals. So if you go to the hospital and they say, well, you need to have this done. And you ask, well, how much is that going to cost? Nowadays, let's see, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I went to the hospital. I had to have some testing done. I said, how much is that going to cost? And they said, well, we'll just bill you. I said, I didn't ask you that. I said, how much is that going to cost? They wouldn't tell me. Now, per law, they have to disclose the prices they're going to tell you, that they're going to charge you, okay? There's more to it than that. But basically, the hospitals got together and they're going to sue the Trump administration because they don't want transparency. They don't want the public to know how much money we're going to get screwed or how much money they're screwing our insurance companies. So that's something that's popping up. There's been you know what facial recognition is, right? It's where the camera takes a picture of you and then a bunch of agencies have that picture and they can tell you who you are just by looking at the picture. The Department of Homeland Security is proposing a rule that would allow the government to use facial recognition data to identify anyone traveling to and from the country. And that includes U.S. citizens. They're already, quote unquote, testing this in some airports. I think Chicago is one of them. That now, you don't even have to have a boarding pass. You don't have to have your ID. You don't have to have anything. You walk up, stand in front of the screen. It scans your face, and it knows everything about you. And it knows that you've already bought a ticket. It knows everything. Well, they've been doing this for non-citizens for the past couple years. You know, you've had to get fingerprinted and have your picture taken. Now, you know how this works, and I know how this works. When the government does a quote-unquote test on something that can violate our privacy, you know for a fact it's coming. They did a test on, before 9/11, they did a test on universal IDs. They were talking about that, where every state had the same identification card, the same requirements to get a driver's license. And everybody said, no, that ain't going to work. Well, guess what? We now have it. Every state has the same. Every state has that same ID, that same requirements for driver's license. So this facial recognition, it's going to be everywhere. It's going to be in a store. In China, as a matter of fact, in China. When you go to a store and you're going to use a credit card, there is a, it looks like a TV turned on its end. So it's probably about 2 feet wide and about 3 feet tall. And when you pay for your product or whatever you're buying, you stand in front of that and it scans you and reads you. And it automatically knows what credit card you have. Because, of course, everybody in China only has one credit card. I guess. I don't know how this works. And if you want to make a phone call, your phone has to scan your face to determine that you are the owner of that phone. Plus, see, that's what they claim. But the reality is the government wants to know who you're calling and when and why. Now, you know, I talked about the Amazon Ring. It's that doorbell that takes that video that you can on your smartphone. It alerts you on your smartphone when somebody's coming to the door. No matter where you are in the world, you can talk to them, blah, blah, blah. And it's a double-edged sword. Because what Amazon has been doing is having parties for law enforcement. It's called a ring party. Open bar, free food, live music, special recognition ceremony, free ring doorbells. What you do, what the cops do is they're given armloads of these ring devices, and they're told, give them away. Give them away. Of course, when you cop gives them away, he gets the person's name, phone number, address, information, gets all the information. So if you think that ring doorbell is being monitored by law enforcement, it is. Maybe not all in all places, but in about 60% of the locations of where the doorbells are, law enforcement, the local law enforcement has access to that doorbell. There's more to it than that, believe me. So does Amazon. Amazon has access, unless you set up your router properly and security codes, everything. And man, you've got to have security better than the Department of Defense, which isn't saying much, unfortunately. But this ring doorbell, keep any of these things, any of the security systems, any of these doorbells, any of these Alexa, turn on the TV, turn off the refrigerator, start the oven, any of this crap, that puts you under supervision, and it puts the control of your house, if you have your whole house, what do they call a smart house, it's under the control of somebody else, and that makes it dangerous for you. Remember Project Veritas? This is an organization where they'd have people go undercover and video all of these criminal Democrats that are doing evil things. Well, the head of that is James O'Keefe. He was responding to actor Mark Ruffalo, who tweeted, "It's time for an economic revolution. Capitalism today is failing us, killing us, and robbing from our children's future." Well, James tweeted back and said, "Why not just exterminate people with money and take their stuff? That's what we're really talking about, right? In fact, we know they do. Stay tuned." He just dropped a little hint that there's something coming down the pike. There's going to be another major episode release. We'll see if the mainstream media dares to pick this one up like they haven't picked up any of the others. Now we're going to do another installment of The Way to Happiness. It's a book. It has 21 precepts in it. Precepts is it's a guiding principle. And it's something that everyone should be following. But unfortunately, we're not. This week, I'm doing number 10. Number 10 is an interesting one. Support a government designed and run for all the people. Unscrupulous and evil men and groups can usurp the power of government and use it to their own ends. Government organized and conducted solely for self-interested individuals and groups gives the society a short lifespan. This imperils the survival of everyone in the land. It even imperils those who attempt it. History is full of such governmental deaths. Opposition to such governments usually just brings on more violence. But one can raise his voice in caution when such abuses are abroad. and one need not actively support such a government. Doing nothing illegal is yet possible by simply withdrawing one's cooperation to bring about an eventual reform. Even as this is being written, there are several governments in the world that are failing only because their people express their silent disagreement by simply not cooperating. These governments are at risk. Any untimely wind of mischance could blow them over. On the other hand, where a government is obviously working hard for all its people rather than for some special interest group or insane dictator, one should support it to the limit. There is a subject called government. In schools, they mostly teach civics, which is merely how the current organization is put together. The real subject, government, goes under various headings: political economy, political philosophy, political power, etc. The whole subject of government and how to govern can be quite precise, almost a technical science. If one is interested in having a better government, one that does not cause trouble, one should suggest it to be taught at earlier ages in schools. One can also read up on it. It's not a very difficult subject if you look up the big words. It is, after all, the people and their own opinion leaders who sweat and fight and bleed for their country. A government cannot bleed. It cannot even smile. It's just an idea men have. It's the individual person who is alive. You. The way to happiness is hard to travel when shadowed with the oppression of tyranny. A benign government designed and run for all the people has been known to smooth the way. When such occurs, it deserves support. Have you ever heard this music before? I did when I was a kid. Every Sunday, we'd go to the Salvation Army Church in San Francisco for supplies. And we'd watch the band play and listen. Oh, it was great. They had, I don't know, maybe they had 100 people in this band. But it was phenomenal, especially for a kid. And there were hundreds and hundreds of other people standing around with us. Let me tell you the story. We lived in Sunnyvale. When I was under 10 years old, I come home from school one day, and there was my dad packing all his stuff in his car, gave me his war medals and said, "Nice knowing you," and he took off. So there's my mom with three kids that she's got to take care of, and a house, for that matter, too. Well, a couple parakeets and some weird fish. Now all of a sudden, she's got to get work. He just left her all high and dry. There was no welfare at the time. We survived on what Grandma and Grandpa could give us, and my mother's brothers and friends. And then one day, my mom put us all in a car on Sunday and said, we got to go to San Francisco. There's some people there that can help us. So we get to San Francisco. It was a nice little drive. Only took about, I don't know, 30 minutes at the time. Now it'd take you 30 minutes to go a block in that area. But we got there, and I heard band playing. And we got to the area, and it was a beautiful little church. There was a band outside, bunch of people in uniforms playing music. So we stood there for about a half an hour listening to them with music. And while we were standing there, there were other people coming up and joining us. Next thing I know, there are hundreds of people standing there. And I'm thinking, this band isn't that good. Well, my mom explained, this is the Salvation Army. And they help people. They were set up by the U.S. government to help hand out staples of foods to people who are needy. See, this is the time when our government actually cared about the people. And we kept in storage, meaning our government kept in storage, excess food that we could live on in an emergency. And this food was not less lightweight stuff. This was like 10-pound cans of flour, 5-pound jars of peanut butter, 5 pounds of cornflakes, cheese, non-fat dried milk, big containers of this stuff. And what they do is they'd cycle it out because they didn't want it to go stale. So they would hand this out, and they gave it to the Salvation Army nationwide to hand out once a month. So this is what my mom meant when she told us we're going to San Francisco and there's some people there to help us. So the Salvation Army was helping us. And we got big boxes full of all of this stuff. And I remember some days all we had to eat and take to school for lunches was peanut butter rolls dipped in cornflakes. I thought that was kind of cool. So did my friends. They thought my mom was a genius for dreaming that up, but that's all we had to eat because that food had to stretch. Well, my mom ended up getting three different jobs and being able to afford the family. Finally, we stopped going to the Salvation Army. But I never forgot that as a child. To this day, that's who I give to. I do not donate to anybody else. I donate to them. And I'd like you to understand who the Salvation Army is. They're not just a bunch of guys or girls who are scamming people. This is something that's real, and it's been around since 1865. So I got a little clip here that's going to explain a lot of it to you.
I see them at Christmas time, out ringing the bells. I've seen their bands playing at the mall and those angel trees.
The Salvation Army? Oh, the bell, the ringing of the bell.
I think those bell ringers are all around the world.
Oh, yeah, they're those people with ringing the bells outside of Walmart during Christmas.
I guess after they collect that money, it goes to different community service programs, although I don't exactly know what they're for.
I would think historically of the uniform, although I believe they're not using that anymore.
Don't they ring the bells at Christmas time?
I really don't know what the Salvation Army is. I reckon they kind of recycle old clothes and furniture and stuff.
I guess the thing it's most known for among people my age group, at least, is the thrift shops.
I think of a church. It's a church.
Oh, how old the Army is. Judging by the uniforms of the guy out in front of my grocery store, I would say at least the 50s.
The bell ringers in front of the store.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. And in the empire of the young Queen Victoria, in the dank and putrid world of industrial England, the story of the Salvation Army begins. It begins with a boy, a tall, stoop-shouldered pawnbroker's apprentice, character worthy of Charles Dickens, the great author of the day. The story of the Salvation Army begins within the heart of William Booth. At 13 years of age, William had been taken out of school and apprenticed to a pawnbroker. His father, an illiterate housebuilder, impoverished himself and died, leaving the family penniless. Desperately poor himself, William had to deal with the desperate poverty of others. Under the sign of the pawnbroker, he learned more than the pricing of cotton umbrellas or the deft handling of pawn tickets. He learned, as from a primer, what poverty did to people. Families appeared before this boy to pledge their worn and dwindling possessions, pitiful little trinkets. Sunday silk handkerchiefs went first to the counter. Wedding rings came last. Over and over, his mother would say to him,
"Be good, William, and then all will be well."
But how was he to be good? The Church of England, where he had been baptized, was a cold and formal place, a place where the rich had their allotted pews, and the poor were not welcome. John Wesley, the giant reformer of religion in England, had been dead some 40 years. His followers had broken away from the Church of England and formed separate sects.
When, as a giddy youth of 15, I was led to attend Wesley Chapel, Nottingham, I felt that I wanted, in place of the life of self-indulgence to which I was yielding myself, a happy, conscious sense that I was pleasing God, living right, and spending all my powers to get others into such a life. The condition of the suffering people around me affected me very deeply. There were children crying for bread to parents whose own distress was little less terrible.
In the 18th century, John Wesley sought to reclaim men without God, the downtrodden, and the desperate who cursed life itself. This fragile little minister, educated at Oxford, took the radical step of preaching in the open air to crowds of drunken miners, a pile of stones as his pulpit.
I thought that there was one God, that John Wesley was his prophet, and that the Methodists were his special people.
In a schoolroom of the Wesleyan Chapel was a plain wooden table, and at that table people were kneeling, confessing their sins, and surrendering their lives to God. pale, thin, and nervous. The boy knelt at their side.
I made up my mind that God Almighty should have all there was of William Booth.
I heard the first sermon he ever preached. It was in a small cottage in Kidd Street. He had come straight from work. There was a box placed upside down on the table for a desk, with a candle and a Bible. Poor women came into the parlour, bringing their own chairs with them. Some men stood in the doorway, afraid to come in lest they be converted. Will Booth's sermon, oh, how well I remember it. It was very gentle and tender, and so strange for a young man to preach that it almost made some of the women smile. He talked of little children learning to walk, how they toddled and swayed and came near to falling. He said how difficult a thing it was to learn to trust their tiny feet and advance with courage. Then he said it was just as difficult to lead a true Christian life, and that we should be on the lookout for helping people, especially those who were just beginning to live that life. Hard words would not help them, sitting still would not help them. We must go and do something to make it less hard for them to walk straight. I heard a very different sermon in Red Lion Square. I remember how he called out in his great voice.
Friends, I want to put a few straight questions to your souls. Have any of you got a child at home without shoes to its little feet? Are your wives sitting now in dark houses, waiting for you to return without money? Are you going away from here to the public houses to spend on drink, money that your wives need for food, and your children for food?
It was all like that. I think there had never been such preaching in the open streets before.
After 6 years, his apprenticeship ended. Unable to find work, he moved to London, where he was desperately lonely, and the only job to be found was in a pawn shop. He settled above the shop. Soon after, he sought opportunities to preach in the nearby Wesleyan Chapel. His zeal was not always appreciated. But Edward Rabbits, a wealthy boot manufacturer, heard him preach and was so impressed, he offered to support William for 3 months if he would devote himself solely to preaching. On Good Friday, April 10th, 1851, his 23rd birthday, William accompanied Mr. Rabbits to a service in a schoolroom. There, he fell in love with Catherine Mumford. After the meeting, Booth escorted Miss Mumford to her home by hackney coach.
That little journey will never be forgotten by either of us. He impressed me, and we struck in at once in such a wonderful harmony of view and aim and feeling that it seemed as though we had intimately known and loved each other for years. Before we reached my home, we both suspected, we felt as though we had been made for each other, and that henceforth the current of our lives must flow together.
Catherine Mumford, 4 months older than William, was the only daughter, while three of her four brothers died as infants. Semi-invalid due to a spinal defect, Catherine absorbed education in solitude, reading and forming her own judgments. The Bible was her earliest lesson book. Before she was 12, she had read it from cover to cover 8 times. Her likes and dislikes were equally strong. She hated worldliness, cruelty, and intoxicants. She loved animals, the truth, and the downtrodden. The earliest desire of these two young people not to allow any thought of their own happiness to interfere with their duty to God delayed their marriage for 3 years. William accepted an invitation to become circuit minister in an area that spread 30 miles. Catherine's letters sustained him.
My dearest William, your desire is to do the will of God, and he will guide you. Never mind who frowns, if God smiles.
My own dear Catherine, I feel uncommonly tired and weary this morning. My head aches, and I feel altogether out of order. I walked home from Greenwich last night. I ought to have ridden.
My dearest love, I have read your letter again since writing the enclosed, and have opened the envelope to send you another line. don't sit up singing till 12 o'clock after a hard day's work. Such things are not required by either God or man. And remember, you are not your own.
My dearest Kate, I want a sermon on the flood, one on Jonah, and one on the judgment. Nothing moves people like the terrific.
On one subject, there was a sharp difference of opinion.
I would not encourage a woman to begin preaching, although I would not stop her on any account.
Oh, prejudice, what it will not do. That woman is in any respect except physical strength and courage inferior to man, I cannot see cause to believe. And I'm sure no one can prove it from the word of God.
I am for the world's salvation. I will quarrel with no means that promises help.
On June 16th, 1855, they were married. After 1 week's honeymoon, they began a whirlwind tour of Lincoln, Bristol, Bradford, Manchester, Sheffield. Within months, all these cities felt the cyclone impact of Booth's personality. The first three of their eight children were born in different towns. In Gateshead, a town nicknamed the Converting Shop due to the impact of William, Catherine began working with alcoholic men. Within a few weeks, 10 of these men had turned away from drinking and met her each week for Bible reading and prayer. Catherine was a very liberated woman for her time, so when she heard an inner voice telling her to preach, she knew God was speaking to her. With great fear and trepidation, she acted on it and found that William and the Gateshead congregation welcomed her preaching enthusiastically. It was the first sultry week of July, and Booth was invited to preach in a tent in the old burying ground in Whitechapel. For all the crusading years of his life, he had sought a human jungle. Now he walked in its midst. London's 100,000 pubs laid end to end would have stretched a full 30 miles. In East London, every fifth shop was a gin shop. Beer shops were open 18 hours a day. A man could become drunk for a penny. For liquor, parents neglected their children. Girls sold their virtue. Men became criminals. He saw five-year-olds blind drunk in doorways. William Booth did not look upon the wretched scene of his day as a social worker might today. Only, and always, he saw the salvation of the soul as the answer to man's need. If a man righted himself with God, all would be well.
When I saw those masses of poor people, so many of them without God or hope in the world, my heart went out to them. I walked back to our West End home and said to my wife, "Oh, Kate, I found my destiny. These are the people for whose salvation I've been longing all these years."
I remember the emotion this produced in my soul. I sat gazing at the fire, and the devil whispered to me, "This means another departure, another start in life." After a momentary pause for thought and prayer, I replied, "Well, if you feel you ought to stay, stay. We have trusted in the Lord once for our support, and we can trust him again."
That night, the Salvation Army was born. The Whitechapel experience was like preaching in hell, for the atheism of East London was fierce, an atheism that hated the very name of God.
Mr. Booth, he shouted at them finally, and then he gave out a hymn and led the singing until he just drowned out their noise. It seemed as if he'd tear the soul right out of your body. And then in the midst of it all, there'd be a bit that would make you want to cry, or a tale that would set you laughing fit to burst. But all the time you felt he wanted to save your soul. There was no mistake about that.
He began his preaching in the open air, on the long strip of pavement called the Mile End Waste. In all sorts of weather, this tall stranger talked about their souls. After 12 months of unflagging work, his converts tallied only 60. But the work went on. Wealthy philanthropists came staunchly to the rescue. Samuel Morley, a manufacturer, wrote a check as his first annual contribution and asked his friends, a bacon merchant, an Edinburgh tea merchant, and two brothers who were Cardiff shipowners, to do the same.
Professor Orson's Dancing Academy was secured for indoor services. The East London Christian Mission, as they were now called, met in a stable, an old beer house, a lime house, and a wool warehouse.
The windows opened onto the street, and if we opened them, boys threw stones and fireworks through. But our people got used to this, shouting hallelujah when the crackers exploded.
Like his hero John Wesley, he saw himself as a link between the churches and the unchurched.
My first thought was to constitute an evangelistic agency, the converts going to the churches. But to this there were three main obstacles. First, they would not go where they were sent. Second, they were not wanted when they did go. Third, I soon found I wanted them myself.
They put me to work right away. We had open-air meetings, and I remember having to stand conspicuously in my own street. They also gave me sick visiting to do.
William and Catherine could not ignore the physical needs of the people they encountered each day. The mission's first report of 1867 shows how they responded. 16-year-old Bramwell Booth, the eldest, ran a small chain of Food for the Millions shops, which gave the poor hot soup at all hours and three-course dinners for sixpence. These were revolutionary activities at that time and came about as a compassionate response to people in need. Not a religion of stained glass windows and the music of Bach, but of soap and a square meal with noise, cheerful songs, and everyone so busy they could not be bored.
Hello, hello, hello. Some people go for funny drinks and down and by the pail, like coffee, cocoa, tea or milk, or even Adam's ale. For my part, you can keep the lot. I never would complain. I never touch the blooming stuff. I only drink champagne. For Champagne Charlie is me name.
Booth hired the Effingham Theatre on Sunday evenings and advertised for 3,000 people to come and fill it. Crowds of idle and dissolute characters filled the theater, but he held their attention. And then Booth and his early Salvationists did more than take over the actual theater. They took over the music as well. Booth felt that if a man was happy and he had discovered his savior, then why not use a tune that everybody knew to let everyone know? So Champagne Charlie became this.
Bless his name, he sets me free. Bless his name, he sets me free. Oh, the blood, the precious blood, I'm trusting in the cleansing flood. Bless his name, he sets me free. Bless his name, he sets me free. I know the past is washed away, and now in Jesus I am free. In Jesus I am free, I'm free.
Over 80 music hall songs acquired religious lyrics, and Booth declared, why should the devil have all the best tunes? From the first, the entire family was in the thick of it. With infinite care, the children were fitted to life, not with the ministry, but into it.
Our mother used to patch our clothes and make us proud of the patches.
Until the mission was 2 years old, Catherine held her own series of evangelistic meetings, exclusively in the West End, and raised great sums of money for the work.
When we were little, there were those who condoled with us because we saw so little of our mother. It was so unusual for a woman to go onto the public platform that her work was not understood. We really saw more of our mother than did those children whose mothers were society women who went on the rounds of endless calls, attended balls and receptions. We were impressed by her example and tried to be like her.
I remember the first Christmas day I spent in their home. The general determined that his children should have a thoroughly old-fashioned Christmas. The children were full of excitement, and I really thought it would be a day of the purest happiness. When the general returned from preaching in Whitechapel on Christmas morning, he looked dreadfully white and drawn, as if he had some grievous worry. Oh, he did his best to enter into the fun and frolic, but it was no use. He kept relapsing into silence and gloom. And suddenly he burst out, I'll never have a Christmas like this again. Paced up and down like a caged lion, telling us the sights he'd seen that morning at Whitechapel. The poor have nothing but the public house. Sights that other people would see, feel sorry for and forget, would stab him to the heart. Other people would see only the drinking. He saw the poverty, the misery, the disease. The sins of London didn't shock him. They seemed to tear at his heart with claws that drew blood.
True to his word, that Christmas Day was the last one the Booth family ever spent together. The next Christmas, Bramwell and the others ranged the slums distributing plum puddings cooked in the Booth kitchen. It was a foreshadowing of the millions of Christmas dinners the army would later distribute in the Whitechapels of the world. Booth's movement had been growing more quickly than even he had intended. Weekly operating costs, which in 1870 were £50 a week, grew so fast that in 10 years the poor alone contributed £14,500 weekly. Booth had done the directing, recording, and bookkeeping, with Bramwell as his aide. Organized help was needed.
We had to build the ship while we're at sea, and not only build the ship, but master the laws of navigation.
George Scott Railton was 24 years old when he arrived to take up his position as secretary to Booth. Railton was a lovable eccentric, capable of laughing until the tears ran down his face. Indifferent to sacrifice, he would preach until he was hoarse and pray until his knees were petrified. In 1878, William, Bramwell, and Railton were checking an article for the Christian Mission's annual report. The Christian Mission, it said, is a volunteer army. Bramwell interrupted to say, I'm not a volunteer, I'm a regular or nothing. William stopped short, thought hard for a moment, and seized his pen. He crossed out volunteer, salvation. The idea caught on like wildfire. Uniforms were adopted. Members became soldiers. Soldiers fired cartridges with their weekly donations. Evangelists were captains and majors serving in local corps and working from a citadel. Salvationists did not die. They were promoted to glory. And William Booth was no longer general superintendent, but the general of the Salvation Army. The new army found its way across the sea when Amos Shirley, with his wife and 16-year-old daughter, Eliza, Salvationist from Coventry, England, settled in Philadelphia and opened fire in an abandoned chair factory. Eliza wrote the general of their work and asked him to send reinforcements.
Dear Eliza, if you're determined to start a religious work in America, you will do well to organize it along the line of the army. If you do this, you have my permission to call it the Salvation Army. General William Booth.
It's 1880. Just 15 years after the Salvation Army's birth, New York newspapers recorded the arrival of a young man in full military uniform, accompanied by what were described as seven hallelujah lassies. His name was George Scott Railton, and he claimed to have orders from General William Booth of the Salvation Army to begin the Army's work in the United States. Near the docks in Battery Park, Railton and the seven lassies attracted considerable attention with their singing and their preaching. He claimed he was ordered to wage war against evil and despair, and then he marched all who would follow to Mrs. Doolittle's Five Points mission.
In the summer of 1880, as the Army's first commissioner, Railton traveled 4,200 miles in 49 days, delivering 80 messages. In the fall, he moved national headquarters, which was only a few papers, a table, a chair, and a bedstead in a basement, to St. Louis, Missouri. In St. Louis, he issued the first war cry. Commissioner Railton strongly believed that any expansion of the work must come from new converts recruited from within the countries invaded. The general ordered him home a year later because in Britain, in the early 1880s, the opposition was fierce. Salvationists had campaigned hard against excessive drinking, and many pubs came close to ruin as heavy drinkers turned to God. A skeleton army was organized to disrupt open-air meetings, and salvationists were pelted with rotten food, mud, and stones. Riots erupted, and salvationists came off badly in court as well as on the street. But persecution did bring one tremendous and unexpected benefit. Just outside Salisbury, in a cottage, lived a builder named Charles Fry. He had three grown sons, Fred, Ernest, and Bertram.
Wait, Bertram. Bertram, you got a pause there?
Pause, yeah.
Yeah, you all got a pause. Same time, right. And we'll try that again. From the top. This time, watch me on the pause, right? One, two, two, two.
In the evening, when the work was done, they played music together. The Fries were staunch Methodists who heard that hooligans were roughing up local street meetings. What was needed was a bodyguard. And while they were there, they might as well bring along their instruments. So the first Salvation Army band was born.
Have you been to Jesus for the cleansing war? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? Are you fully
Tambourine sales skyrocketed. The Fries gave up their business to start the Army's musical department. The first year, there were 400 Salvation Army bands. Life in the Booth home had taken a grim turn. Catherine was terminally ill with cancer.
I shall never forget, in this world or the next, that meeting. I'd been watching for the cab and had run to meet her and help her up the steps. She tried to smile through her tears, but drawing me into the room, she told me the verdict of the doctors. I sat down, speechless. She knelt beside me and said to me, "You know what my first thought was? That I should not be there to nurse you at your last hour."
She died at age 61, surrounded by her family. There was great sadness at her death. Catherine Booth was publicly acknowledged as one of the most remarkable women of the 19th century. Besieged by more homeless and hungry people than the army could cope with, to earn money, William had begun writing a book about the situation in what he called Darkest England. Shortly after Catherine's death, he finished his book, In Darkest England and the Way Out, in which he poured out his feelings. He wrote passionately about the submerged tenth of the population, the poor, who had no rights.
When in the streets of London a cab horse, weary or careless or stupid, trips and falls and lies stretched out in the midst of the traffic, there's no question of debating how he came to stumble. Before we try to get him on his feet again, cab horse is a real illustration of poor, broken-down humanity. These are the two points in the cab horse's charter. When he's down, he's to be helped up. And while he lives, he has food, shelter, and work.
He devised a social scheme which would offer food and shelter for the homeless and provide them with work and training for work. He wanted to see them become self-supporting and self-respecting. The book was a huge bestseller, and William Booth became the most talked about man in Britain. People began to grasp what he was saying. In the play Major Barbara, George Bernard Shaw criticized the army for using tainted money to do its work. To this, Booth answered,
"We will wash it in the tears of the widows and orphans and lay it on the altar of humanity."
William never got over Catherine's death, but for the remaining 22 years of his life, he threw himself into his work. Always an innovator, he used the most modern technology available to him.
"To reach and gather these, I must make a big sound and paint with a big brush, big as the stars."
Now, a year or so ago, I actually did an interview with one of the heads of the Salvation Army here in Coeur d'Alene, Northern Idaho area, and I was surprised to find out this guy is a general. Now, the Salvation Army is set up as an army, right? So they have the same designations. This guy is a general. Do you know how much money he makes a year? Between $40,000 and $50,000. That's what he makes a year. Now, if you look at the other charities out there, City of Hope, the head of that is $2.4 million. The American Cancer Society, $2 million a year. American Heart Association, $1.7 million. Shriners Hospital, $1.6 million. Now, these are your donations, okay? Your donations you give to these organizations. And this is what these people make. The NRA, Wayne LaPierre, $1.4 million. Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, $1.3 million. National Jewish Health Foundation, $1.3 million. Wildlife Conservation Society, $1.3 million. St. Jude's Research Hospital, $1.2 million. And you see their commercials all the time on TV. National Urban League, $1.1 million. And it goes on and on and on and on. The head of Salvation Army, he doesn't make any more than the generals do. In fact, here's something most people don't know. You ever hear the term March of Dimes? Jerry Lewis used to promote that all the time. I remember that in grade school, we'd get a little card that we could slip dimes in. And when we filled it up, we can turn it in and we'd get gold stars. And every store had a little stand there that you could slip dimes in. So it was March of Dimes. Turns out, a dime is all that gets used for help. 90 cents out of every dollar is going to pay somebody's salary in March of Dimes. You know United Way? Well, my aunt worked in that, and she made... And now this is in probably about 1975. She was making $1.5 million a year. This is all a big scam. All of these charity donation places are... Not all of them. There are Wounded Warrior projects out there, but you know... Every disaster, every single disaster in the United States, the very first people to show up is the Salvation Army. Every single one, floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, you name it, they show up first, not the Red Cross. About the year 2000, the wife of the founder of McDonald's, Joan Kroc, K-R-O-C, she donated the largest charity donation in the history of the world to the Salvation Army so that they could open up what's known as Kroc Centers. These were big centers that were a combination of gymnasium, swimming pools, conference center, a church. They're called Kroc Centers, and there's about 22 or 3 of them right now throughout the United States. There happens to be one here in Coeur d'Alene. The donation she gave was $1.5 billion. And I have a little clip here to explain what the Kroc Center is.
This commercial strip along University Avenue was having some issues about the time. The businesses who had been on this property were all gone. It was sort of boarded up. It basically was sitting sort of as an eyesore. And I remember at actually one of the council meetings sort of raising my hand when they wanted an endorsement for their self-storage project. And I said, you know, I think we should wait and see what the other offers are. And I was quickly pulled aside after that meeting by the council member who wanted to know, what do you know about this? And I said, well, I don't know anything. Why? And she said, there's something better coming.
Back here at home, the woman known for her kindness throughout San Diego is living up to that well-deserved reputation. The heiress to the McDonald's fortune, Joan Kroc, has made a huge donation to the Salvation Army, the largest single gift to the organization in its 118-year history.
Well, imagine for a moment an Olympic-sized swimming pool and an ice skating rink right here full of hundreds of children, their parents and grandparents. Well, that's what's in store at this vacant lot at the corner of University Avenue and Aragon Drive.
Actually, this project took seed a few years ago when our former mayor, Maureen O'Connor, said, you know, I'd like to take you on a little tour of San Diego. I was troubled with what I observed, and it left a deep impression with me, one that would not go away. It also left me with a persistent desire to try to do something to make life a little happier for the families, particularly the children, as I realized that they desperately needed a safe gathering place, a place with facilities and trained professionals to nurture their social skills, arts appreciation, and athletic potential.
She came from simple means, and she felt that if given the opportunity, people without means could achieve a great deal. It was certainly expressing the Salvation Army mission in a new way that we've never done before. And so that was the challenge.
My grandma was so excited at the groundbreaking of the center. And I remember her jumping in the Bobcat ready to break ground. Were you guys here when she did that? So hilarious. In her nicest St. John suit.
It's a wonderful, wonderful day. And it's just great to be in the neighborhood, isn't it, kids? I love it. I have two wishes, two hopes, and one is that in the next 100 years, that tens and tens of thousands of children will have had thousands of hours to enjoy this beautiful, beautiful new facility. And my other hope is that as you grow and develop and are nurtured, that your hearts will never, ever become hardened. You're what the world is banking on. It has been a beautiful, beautiful day, and I'm sure that this is something that Ray would have liked me to do. And I'm sure he's looking down. I hope he's looking down. But I know he'd be happy and proud of today.
My grandma was so happy with how the center was built and how beautiful it was, and so excited about all the children and the opportunities that they were going to have.
But you know, every time you saw Mrs. Kroc in this facility, I don't remember ever seeing her when she wasn't smiling. I think from the very beginning, she wanted to do this a number of times. Matter of fact, before she passed away, she talked about doing one in Chicago. She talked about doing one in Mississippi. And so I think it was always her dream that these centers, she referred to them as a beacon of light and hope in a community. And she wanted these centers to be all over the United States.
My grandma said a lot about the Salvation Army. She trusted them wholeheartedly.
You know, I think that 10 years, it's a great start because they're still being constructed. I think right now we're somewhere around 20 or so in the nation. There's still 5 or 6 on the drawing board. I think the future is going to be an exciting place.
Now, for gym services at the Kroc Center, they charge. And they charge other things. Different things can happen there, and they can charge for it. But that their money goes to support the poor, goes to actually perform. And I think how it works is 96 cents out of every dollar given to the Salvation Army goes towards the poor and to help people in case of emergencies and things like that. Real simple. If you're going to donate money, give to the Salvation Army. They actually use it. And I was in a forest fire one time. I remember this, and they stopped us, and we were outside of Eureka, California, and they stopped the family. They were stopping people on the highway saying, "We need your help. We got to fight this fire," forcing you to volunteer to fight the fire. And they had shovels and everything else. And on the highway, I think this was Highway 101, on the highway were Salvation Army trucks set up with coffee and sandwiches for everybody. And they also had first aid equipment there and all of that stuff. I remember that. So if you're going to donate to anyone, donate to the Salvation Army. I hope you learned something from this. I hope this changed your mind a little bit. Now, my next show is going to be a replay. And then my Christmas show, just so you guys know, is going to be The Miracle on 34th Street. And It's a Wonderful Life. And it's going to be the original radio performances. Right after the movies were done, then they wanted them to do radio opera, whatever you want to call it. So they did this. And so we're talking, these are old. This is old time radio theater. So I won't see you again until next year. You have a Merry Christmas.